Hi, Jeff. How are you? anyway, we just combine that stuff, and I feel like I never. I just thought I don't want to censor myself. I want to just be totally free with it. We're in a made-up country. We're mixing wars together, and we're mixing up nationalities and cultures and everything. And this kid, this stateless person, you know, stateless is a big word in that time and place. And he's from I don't know if he's an Arab or a Jew or some mixture of them. And I don't know what happens in this. Seems to be a war that's starting in 1932. It's not exactly lining up with anything. So I just felt like we'll just make our story, make our experience, and whatever. However, what I've been reading or interested in is going to go in there. Everybody knows all this stuff, we'll just see what that adds up to. That's a very long-winded answer, but yeah.
I mean, is it in your intent to have an impact on the audience in terms of?
Well, it's my intent that it's, you know, I mean, it's a choice to make a movie that's in that world.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, you know, and even though it isn't an exact time and place, it is, you know, I mean, we know what we're referring to and drawing on. Everybody knows all that, so. You know, that's the thing I've been, especially during that time, is somehow what I was thinking about every day, just because of what I was reading and that sort of thing. So, and where I was living. Anyway, that's my attempt to answer that.
I feel like location plays a big part in your movies. It's always Life Aquatic, the submarine, the train in Darjeeling, obviously the hotel. But at what point is location something you start thinking about? Because you obviously have a story and the characters and things. What point do you start thinking of locations and where, what you have to create for it?
Well, with this one, we made the script. And then we went on this kind of journey around Eastern Europe. And we went to Vienna and Budapest and all around Czech Republic. And then spent a lot of time traveling in Germany, a little bit in Poland. And we were looking for where we're going to shoot the movie, but also I kind of thought, for various reasons, especially tax, incentive, we were kind of feeling like it's going to end up being Germany anyway, but we wanted to go all over the place, and we sort of found something everywhere. You know, we collected all kinds of ideas, and a part of the story that wasn't in the script. In the script, you know, there was this hotel in the 30s that was. When it was in its heyday, and there was the 60s when it was in decline and, you know, on its last legs. After we came back, after this trip, it became communist, and it got a sort of, you know, just in the architecture of it, we put in a bit of history and whatever it is, ideology, you know, a regime. So
it's not the script stage. You don't have a location already pictured in your mind. When you're writing the script, or
no, you know, no. I mean, during the script, I was looking at some old pictures, you know, old photographs and things, and I had found one particular hotel that I liked, but you know, it's nothing like that anymore. So it was more like an inspiration than a possible location.
You've worked with Robert D. Yeoman a few times now. I was wondering, how's your collaboration evolved, and what kind of aesthetic did you want to achieve with the Grand Budapest Hotel?
Well, I don't know how it's evolved, but you know, the thing is usually we might have, you know, we might have some rules for that we would come up with for a certain movie that we're going to try to do. I mean, you know, in this one we had these different shapes and formats that we were going to work with. Sometimes we try to just limit how much gear we're going to have and how we're going to go about it. It really has to do with, you know, the last movie we had these little kids in walking around in the woods together, and I don't want to go out and do that with 60 people. So we made a decision about the whole movie really based on based on that kind of situation. And in fact, you know, we made a choice based on how tall these people were. There's these cameras that you can handhold, these French 16 millimeter cameras that you don't put on your shoulder, you hold them like this. It's just a better way to film somebody like that. I mean, if you're going to do a lot of handheld stuff with these guys. And that sort of affected the whole movie. So, anyway, I'm rambling.
No, that answers
the question. Is there anything you can't do that you come up with?
Bob.
Such shots are very complicated.
Well, you know, I'll tell you one thing. Bob, he's a great guy. We've done a million movies here. Every movie I've done with him. But I've done a lot of stuff with other directors of photography who were great, like Darius Kandji. I did some stuff with Darius Kandji. I worked with Bruno Delbonnel. Am I saying his last name right?
I think so.
Yeah. And some other guys. Bob is by far the best operator of anybody that I've come across. He just, you know, he's 63 or something now, but he's still you know the best at that for me. Just the physicality of operating, he's great with.
Did you feel that this was, or were you aiming for this to be your most ambitious work to date? Because the script is so dense and the scope feels really big, and it's a story within a story within a story. Did you feel like you were trying to raise the bar quite a bit?
I thought about that. I think I knew it was going to be a kind of big undertaking at a certain point. I mean, somewhere along the way, I started thinking, "Oh, this is going to be hard." But I did always feel like it. I mean, the thing we were talking about before, there's just a historical element to it that is, there's just something heavy that's there that I was aware of. And, you know, I've never had a movie where, there's this much blood.
You create a lot of imaginary worlds. You know, there's the imaginary New York of Tenenbaum's, the imaginary world of this, and even Life Aquatic seems to have its, imaginary species. What draws you to creating those kinds of, rather than doing New York in the 90s specifically?
Yeah. It's just to make a space to work in. I mean, the real answer is just because I like to. I think on one hand, usually the characters that I'm writing are inspired by people in real life in one way or another, and I'm doing something that relates to my own experience or anyway my own interest. Nevertheless, I feel like the dialogue, the writing, ends up being not entirely naturalistic, not by my choice particularly, and somehow I feel like it needs its own world to exist in. And then I like to, you know, I have a whole group of people we've worked together for years, and that's kind of what we like to do together, is then kind of make the place for these characters to do their thing.
Did you ever want to be like an inventor or something when you were younger?
I wanted to be an architect.
Well,
yeah.
I guess that's sort of the same.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, there's some of that stuff in this.
If I could just ask a quick question related to that, a frame that jumped out at me.
Can I throw in one thing that
sure.
relates to your first question, by the way? Mm-hmm. Just the thing we were just talking about, the reason there is a certain amount of blood in this movie without me, that actually might be the answer in a weird way, if that makes any sense. But anyway, go ahead.
The scene it's the first scene with the girl in the cemetery. There's that one building off to the top right hand corner with that window, and it's very clearly an eye. A window is in.
Yeah.
Where is that place? How did that?
Well, that's a
come
thing.
Into the making of the scene.
Yeah, that's a thing in that part of the world, or this part of the world even, but especially a little further to the east. There's a there's a German word for it.
That type of window?
Yeah, they're like sleepy eye windows or something like that. And they're, you know, they're, you see them, you see three of them on a rooftop. It's a very, but that's part of the thing of traveling around before the movie. We saw millions of things like that. And in fact, that shot is like a composite of, you know, it's a different places we like that are made into one shot. That's kind of, that, but yeah, it's very interesting, very striking, I mean, weird thing. It's really like feels like fairy tale stuff when you first see one of these things, driving around in Poland or something, a house looking out at you from down
like
the road.
To wink at you.
Yeah, very strange.
The aspect ratio thing is one of my favorite aspects of this film, and I love that you made the decision that when you go from 185 to 137, that it the height expands.
137, you know the exact number. No, pretty good, pretty good.
133
is what I always thought it was, but then the camera guys, German camera guys, are very precise about it. You have to stop saying that. It's not 133. I always heard Academy. I was always told 133, but yeah. It's not apparently. Right. It's. You know, tiny bit wider, I guess.
But it's wonderful the way the height changed. It was almost like watching IMAX at the screen.
It's good.
So what
did you see IMAX?
Well, it had a hugeness to it.
But did you see an IMAX? No, you didn't.
At the Cinemax theater yesterday, number 7.
Oh, but seeing this movie, yeah.
Is there going to be an IMAX version?
But you know, I was thinking of IMAX. I mean, IMAX. Yeah. You know, sometimes depending on where you sit, IMAX. You have that thing of the movies here. It's also down there. You know, which is pretty amazing. And this one, we did do a thing, which is, what I didn't want to do is have the movie suddenly get smaller. So as a result of that, we sort of made it at the beginning of the movie. I don't know if you noticed, but there's black on all sides. We actually made the beginning little so that it's the first time you use the top and bottom of the frame when it goes to 133, just so it feels like it's expanding. But you know, it's like we never would have been able to do it a few years ago, because even when we did Bottle Rocket years ago, part of the conversation that we had in advance of the movie was maybe we could do this Academy, and it was like the theaters would all, the projectionists would all have to, you know, you couldn't do it in those days. Yeah. It was a whole thing. Now it's, you just say you're going to do it, and you do it.
Anyway, I was so delighted with how it looked yesterday, but there was a very, very quick, very brief, minor error in the projection when I first saw it.
Oh, really? Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
No biggie. You corrected right.
Let's make note.
I was just thinking.
Oh, with the aspect ratio.
The masking was forgotten about very briefly.
Uh-huh.
It was no biggie. It was over in a second. But
that's
I was
funny.
Just thinking, given the fact that there's a...
Well, I'll tell you something. We did. You know how at the beginning of the last waltz, there's this thing that says, play this movie loud or something like that. It's like, we've made a little card that says, projectionist, please set to 185, right? And with a thing. That I said, my theory was, we did it with different colors and stuff. And I said, well, you know, I'm trying to sell this to everybody. This is not for just the projectionist. This is like a thing to put in front of the movie. But it was a real last minute thing, and we haven't gotten on it, but we should probably do it. I mean, we should probably get it in there. I mean, now we were talking about just doing it for home video, saying, because this could be confusing. People could start messing around with the thing, and then they've messed up the whole movie. Good.
Given
that
good the
note.
Average projectionist in a Plex today is not...
Is there one?
It's just, yeah. No, there's just it's kids who are doing the candy stand. They have the running the... You know.
Yeah.
So I just hope that there is kind of control, because the potential, and this
for
is
confusion.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Some of those
so what was the inspiration for changing ratios during the movie?
Well, it was first to just do it all Academy, and then I thought, and then the sort of traditional thing of, so how do we do it? Are we going to do some of it in black and white, or what are we going to do? What's our way going to be of these different choices for how to separate this time period from that time period? And I thought, well, you know, the best would be if I could use these Technoscope. This thing that I did with Darius, we use these Technoscope anamorphic lenses. They're really old and strange, and you know, if you look at a freeze frame of some of these shots, the edges are just so blurry you couldn't identify people and things. And I think they did like spaghetti westerns and things with these lenses. So I thought maybe we can use these lenses again and we'll sort of make these different parts like they're just different movies. Mm-hmm. So that's where I came in. And then I just started, I also thought, we're so used to just seeing these shapes bounce around like this, and you know, we see things letterboxed and whatever it's called when you letterbox the side so often now.
Letterbox.
Yeah. We're just used to it. But I will say when you sign a contract to do a movie, it says you are obligated to turn in this. And when a team of lawyers sees this little rewrite here we put into the contract, it stirs up a lot of trouble. The amount of I'm sure the legal fees just to agree that we're going to go ahead and do this, really, they mounted.
But it fits thematically. I mean, this nostalgia of the movie kind of fits the nostalgia of the formats.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always have loved this Academy shape, and it's really the big. It does remind me of old movies, you know. I mean, when I see it, even though ours is a color movie, and it's Ralph Fiennes, it's just the fact that you have these shots where we're framed here, and we're used to this, and suddenly we're seeing this, and that's how I see Humphrey Bogart, you know.
Mm-hmm. There's certain themes that I would say tie your work together. I was wondering, when you sit down to write, do you have a theme in mind, or is that just like an afterthought?
It's a never thought, really. I don't really want to think about themes. But, you know, I want to just think about the experience of the movie and not I feel like as soon as I reduce it to a theme, I'm not going to have come up with. Once I write that sentence, it won't be that great, you know. So I feel like there's more potential for it to mean something more interesting if I'm not forcing it to mean something I've already decided.
But because there's so much great theme in this. There's so much like, you know, a man out of time, a man in era, like nostalgia for an era that doesn't exist, a golden age. Is that not conscious, or is any of that personal? Like yourself feeling like romanticizing different periods? I mean, there's so much great theme and texture.
Well, I think it's, you know, what I think it's just what I'm interested in is what I want to put in there. That's what I mean. I'm going to spend however much time it takes to do one of these things. And it's only going to be the ideas that I can come up with and my collaborators that we can come up with together. And that's going to be what we're interested in. I don't want to make it something that isn't digging into things. I just don't want to ID them.
Right. Sure. Are you romantic for those past eras, like, or that time? Or?
Well, there's this thing. I started going on this website of the Library of Congress has this thing, Photochrome Library. I don't know if we put that in the press notes or anything. I'm not sure if that, maybe we didn't write about that. They it's this collection of these old, of these black and white photographs that this Swiss company and this, I think maybe like St. Louis, these two companies did this joint venture where they had photographers take cityscapes and landscape photographs all over the world, and they colorized them, and they printed them, they mass produced them, and they sold them as these little, you know, they're like this big, and they're these thin paper, and they're very beautiful views. Very rarely did they have people in them, or if they're people, they're crowds and things like that, and they're taken between 1895 and 1910, I'd say, something like that. That's their run of these things. And there are thousands of them, and they're all over the world. But you know, our interest is Austro-Hungarian Empire and Prussia and other parts of Europe. And it's, I would say this is like we have Google Earth of turn of the century. Mm-hmm. Access to. Well, and this really became, I sort of like. When we made Rushmore many years ago, when I was writing the script, I was thinking of places in my school where I'd gone. During this movie, because I was looking at these things, I saw this movie through, you know, the backdrop was through this this collection that we own, that we theoretically is ours. Often we went to these exact places. Many of them are like views of the time people would go to just see this view. They'd have built a terrace or something, and it's just there for you to visit. There's a path and a thing. And you can't go to too many of these without starting to feel a little bit of sadness, because you know, there's just so many more people, and the world is just not like this anymore. And it does, if you if you have any kind of nostalgic bone in your body, a process like that kind of. But I will say that's not my experience in life in general. I mean, I've been spending a lot of time in Europe in the last 10 years or 15 years, and it, to me, it's really just, I like being here because it's an adventure, and I just enjoy walking down a street that I've never been down before here because it's got all these layers of history and everything.
One of the draws for the movie is the poster with, I guess, Wes Anderson players, a lot of people he worked before. And it's almost like a super group. I mean, and they kind of have smaller parts mostly. But at what point, you've written a script with a lot of characters, do you just like email or call everyone and say, I might have a part for you, can you come to Germany? Like, how do you actually approach getting everyone? Did you just do that?
That's it. That's it. For anybody who I've got, you know, anybody who I can do that with them, that's what I did. You know, I sent a lot of these, I sent the script, I sent, you know, my pitch.
We know about the animation. We've heard about it.
The animation that comes later.
Okay.
And then some of these photochrome pictures I would attach. Most of them. I did direct a few people I didn't know, but even Rafe and I had not worked together before. But I knew Rafe. I knew how to reach him, and I'm trying to think of who I didn't know, like Murray Abraham and Tom Wilkinson. I didn't reach out directly, but I think maybe Tom Wilkinson, I think I would have to reach him through his agent. But everybody else, I think I can get him directly.
He's more facebook. He's trying to figure out how you got her email.
This is somewhat in relation to what Rodrigo had asked you, but Willem was talking before about that line at the end that Murray delivers, that about a man being already out of his time. I'm flubbing it, but
I know you get
the sense, like, how much of that is you? I mean, do you feel like that type of man?
No, I don't really. But you know, there's two things. One, the guy who we based it on, I don't know that he feels like that, but he is like that. You know, he's somebody who he's by the time he was 15 years old, he was the person he is now, and he's in his 50s now, and he's one of those people who was fully formed young, and he always was friends with people 30 years older than he is, and he has this feeling of being, there's something about him that is like somebody who's 85 in a way. He knows people who you really should be older to have known and things like that. And I said there were two, and I'm trying to remember what the other half of it was. The other thing is, it's in Zweig, in Stefan Zweig. Yeah. It's a big president, and you know, his memoir is about, you know, how Europe changed, how the world changed during the course of his whole life. But the title of the book is The World of Yesterday, and you know, there's something about his description of life before 1914 that is, in a way, the thing that sticks with you the most. It's the most striking thing. It's the thing, to me, I never read a description quite like this of that world. I think it's the end of that world is, you know, he writes his book and he kills himself. That's the thing he's still missing. I related to that a bit.
How much do you feel a part of your characters? Is there maybe one or two whose worldview that you maybe connect to more so than others?
I think so. Yeah, there are. I mean, there's some definitely that I feel like have some, like Rushmore, this one, it's really is like where I went to school. Owen and I use our own specific stuff that happened to us that went into it. most of the other ones are not like that, but they're usually all just it's whatever I'm most interested in at that time, I guess. So they're all personal in one way or another.
Was Finding Tony similar at all to Finding Jason for Rushmore? Because I feel like there's definitely a connection there. You know, Gilmore was telling us a story before about his first day worker, Jason, and being, oh my God. But it's the same thing. It's very,
what did he say? Did it back up? Okay, so what was it? What was said?
It's awful. Bill said that the first day he worked with Jason, he basically drank so much afterwards, he was worried that it wasn't going to work out.
The night before filming.
Jason sucked. That's basically the
And then the next day he was great.
Was it a similar experience trying to find Tony as it was finding Jason back then? Or?
Well, I'm pretty sure Bill has shaped this story a bit over the years. You know, I recognize the parts of it, but there was a process of him feeling comfortable with Jason, but he also made that happen. You know, Jason was acting a little wild because he was like with his hero. I mean, I'm not answering your question. I'm responding to Bill's comments.
Right.
I know how he feels about Jason, after this first thing, he invited us to go to a restaurant to have chicken fried steak, and you know, the three of us had this kind of night out together that Jason didn't drink or anything, and he must have just said I don't feel good about that, but I'm gonna just try to see if I can just make this all fine, and then he did, which I feel he's a guy who can do that. The other thing was Seymour Cassell is the one who did the damage later. That was late in the game. And that was also one of those things where, you know, when you do this, you're going along this movie where you're this company of people working together, and everybody forgets that one of us is 16. And that one of us actually, once this movie is done, has to be back, has homework. You forget how much this guy is not just acting in his first movie, he's also has a job. Which he never had before, has this kind of pressure. And anyway, Seymour helped dramatize that for us with him one night towards the end of the shoot. So anyway, but now what's the actual question?
So then let's go to...
Well, that was just a great answer. Okay.
Then you can go to the parallel with Tony, right?
Is that... parallel with Tony. You know, the thing I learned when we did Rushmore was how long it can take to find some guy that we've never heard of. That one was, we must have spent a year. So this one, as soon as we had a script, I gave it to Scott Rudin and Stephen Rails, and said, if you like this, let's hire 11 casting directors in these countries all over the world, and let's get a guy to paint this portrait of this painting of Boy with Apple, because for all we know we can end up painting it three times and each one takes 3 months or something.
Right.
Luckily, I have these two guys who I've been working with for some years now, and they've just been great. And so the next day we started that happening. But it went the same way as with Jason. We looked all over the world. We looked in England to try to cast this part. We found somebody who lived in Bel Air, and in this case, we had a casting director in Israel and in Beirut and in Morocco, and we cast somebody from Anaheim. What can you do?
How close did Mario get to getting the part?
Did DeMario, the brother.
Yeah.
You're right. I saw Mario's audition first, and I thought, interesting. We might, this is, we kind of pulled him off the thing and put him on the desktop. Mm-hmm. And then I saw the next one, and I knew Mario was never going to get this part. Because the next was Tony. But I feel like Mario is a little bit connected to this movie anyway, because Tony and I did this thing where we would, in the months before the movie, I would have him do the whole movie to me on a video, and then I would do a video responding, and then he would do the movie again to me, and we just went back and forth doing the whole movie, and Mario was his, you know, the person he played the scenes with, who filmed him and did the scenes with him, so he's sort of connected to it in a way.
I'm very curious about how budget has influenced or possibly changed any of your scripts along the way. For example, with this one, was there anything that you guys scripted that you realized this is never gonna, we're never gonna have the money to do this? And I'm just curious about your other films that you've made.
Yeah.
If budget, how that's impacted or changed what you've done.
Well, I mean, it does, but I don't, but you know, I would say we don't do that. We don't do a thing where we say we don't have the money to do this. Because it feels like there's no upside, you know? There's no way we can make ourselves feel good about that. But we just definitely do the thing of saying we're going to do this a very weird way because it's the only way we're going to manage to accommodate it. You know, our... I can't say that our... We have this, you know, skiing sequence in our movie, and in the script, you know, I think you would have... I mean... Well, the first person who looked at the thing and budgeted it was sort of thinking like 3 weeks of, you know, 3 weeks in Switzerland. And I had this vague idea that we could do sort of like the snow globe version of this thing and that that might be more interesting anyway. But if we didn't do this way that we did, we would have been pretty well up against it. Like, I just don't know how we would even begin to go about that with our kind of money. But, you know, I feel like I try to have a rule to not just give up on something that's in the script based on money.
Can you tell us, just from that, how did you make that scene, that magical scene?
Yeah. That is... kind of complicated. For instance, the bobsled run. A part of it is we built the bobsled run that's about, you know, that ultimately is kind of like the size of this room, let's say.
Okay.
We use a kind of a combination of stop motion and live action miniature techniques, plus a lot of digital manipulation. It's really using like the most old fashioned movie techniques with a lot of digital stuff to fuse them together and modify the speeds and all that kind of junk. And then these kind of shots also, we've planned them out and we've figured out what is our strategy going to be for this, and we've got a thing that's sloped down to move the camera through, but we're changing it. We're constantly not getting it good enough yet and having to do something else that might involve shooting another physical element that we're digitally putting in, or, you know, just manipulating it. It's just a very long, ongoing process. That's a pretty vague way to answer that.
Were the actors even there?
Rafe and Tony are there. Willem, in most of the sequence, Willem has some bits at the beginning, but I mean, I'm reluctant to even say this. This is part of why I'm also being vague, because I find it slightly, I don't want to say it. It's not that I don't want to reveal the magic trick. I find when I reveal the magic trick, there's something slightly humiliating about it. but Willem is mostly like, he's a stop motion puppet this tall. Maybe that's obvious, but I'm still reluctant to say it out loud.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye.
Love you all. Guys, got one. Thank you. I'm going to email you guys a funny story.